Welcome to Guerrillapreneur, the Art of Waging Small Business Warfare podcast, teaching Davids how to defeat Goliaths. Now here's your host, Mark Anthony Peterson.
Welcome back to the podcast for entrepreneurs, startups, and business mavericks. If you're not a maverick, you don't have to go home, but you got to get up out of this podcast. In this podcast, we teach entrepreneurs how to defeat the corporate giant. Just like in the story of David and Goliath, David defeated a much taller and stronger Goliath not by fighting the giant in hand-to-hand combat, but by using technology. A slingshot. The slingshot allowed the smaller David to attack from a distance that minimized the advantages that Goliath had over the smaller David. My name is Mark Anthony Peterson. I'm a serial entrepreneur, a futurist, and the managing executive at Serial Consulting, a leading small business strategy and technology consulting firm. I'm also the author of the book Guerrillapreneur, Small Business Strategy for Davids Wanting to Defeat Goliaths, which is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and iTunes. This podcast is brought to you by Serial Consulting. An idea can launch a business. A strategy can take it global. Guerrillapreneurs, I am happy to tell you that we are one step closer to having those Guerrillapreneur Disrupt or Die t-shirts and baseball caps ready to go. Just go over to our Patreon site, patreon.com/guerrillapreneur, and check out the designs. We're hoping to have them done in the next 2 to 3 weeks. And for any of you signing up as a Patreon member, you'll get one of those really cool Guerrillapreneur Disrupt or Die t-shirts or hats. We're really looking forward to getting those in your hands this year. And while you're at it, guys, there are other ways that you can support the show other than being a Patreon member. You can like the show. You can subscribe to the show. You can leave a comment and you can share the show with your friends. That helps us tremendously. It's our 50th episode. I can't believe it. 50. We've made it to the big number. The first major milestone in every podcast. 50 episodes. And in today's episode, we've decided to go back and interview the person who gave us the very first mastermind interview. Robert Armstrong. The young gentleman who founded G Mama's Cookies out of his kitchen and grew that business. Can you believe it? It was almost 3 years ago we had that interview. Well, we're going to go back and catch up with Robert Armstrong and talk to him about that business, all the ups and downs, and try to share some of the learnings he's had in trying to build a cookie empire with you. We spent so much time with him that we broke this up into two parts, part one and part two. The part one will focus on the rise of a cookie empire, and we're going to take you through that in the interview today. I think you're going to enjoy it, and it's also going to be very illuminating for those of you who are entrepreneurs and want to know what it's like to try to build a business from the ground up. Here's my interview with Robert Armstrong, the founder and CEO of the Selma Good Company, and the producers of G Mama's Cookies. All right. Robert, welcome to the 50th episode of Guerrillapreneur. You were the very first mastermind interview. I can't believe it has gone by this fast, 50 episodes. And you taught us a lot in that very first mastermind interview about how you started your business, how you got it off the ground, how you were growing it. Why don't you give everybody kind of a recap of that first interview and re-enlighten the audience to G Mama's and your passion and what you did to get it off the ground, and then we'll transition into where we are today. Because I think there's a lot that the audience can learn from your story.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, I know when we had our first interview, I can't remember exactly where we were in the process of the business, but I know we were in a bunch of stores at that point. Basically, just kind of a shortened down version of the story. I started a cookie company with my grandmother's recipes. I never baked anything in my life, but I knew the cookies were good. And through right after college, I moved back home after a little small stint in Birmingham. It was a difficult time in the economy. It was 2009 at the time, so it was the Great Recession, and so wasn't a whole lot of jobs out there. And honestly, I kind of wanted to do my own thing. So I told my grandmother when I was young that I was going to start a cookie company with her cookies. I wasn't really serious, but kind of one thing led to another, and I decided to give it a shot. I kind of had a vision for it, for the brand, and there really wasn't anything in the market that was like it. Like a cookie that had natural ingredients, and that was really at the beginning of kind of this natural organic sort of movement with food products, especially in grocery stores. But I started baking by hand, and my goal ultimately was to obviously automate the process and grow it into a real business. But from the get-go, I really didn't know what I was doing. I mean, that's probably why I started the business in the get from the start, was because I just didn't know what I was getting into. But I baked in a small, like a 200 square foot abandoned restaurant kitchen for about 2 years.
And well, before that though, you were like making them in your kitchen, right? Before you got to the restaurant.
The way I started it is I sold all my belongings, or a lot of them, on eBay. I had like a bike and some guitars and stuff like that and then I took a lien against my car. I got $7,500. I had a cheap 4Runner at the time, and and then got my grandmother to teach me how to bake them in her kitchen, so I went out and pre-sold to three stores locally. I got into two drug stores and a kind of specialty grocery store here. Got them to pre-order.
So that means they paid up front?
Well, no, they just
made an order.
Yeah, they made an order.
Now, how much did you raise at $7,500 against your car? How much more did you get for your other stuff on eBay?
Probably about $2,500.
So about $10,000 in seed capital up front.
Yeah.
And guys, you the last episode, I went through the 10 craziest things that founders have done to get their business off the ground. Some have thrown parties. The Airbnb founders sold breakfast cereal. Yeah. Right. I mean, so for you guys out there who are thinking, I can't find the money. Yeah. The money's there.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, what do you want to sacrifice?
Absolutely.
And you sacrifice your car, your personal stuff, like your guitar. I mean, that had to have some sentimental value.
Definitely.
But the business meant more. $10,000, seed capital, and now grandma's teaching you how to cook the cookies.
Yeah, she thought it was hilarious that I was going to start this. I mean, but she was willing to help. And I really didn't think baking would be that difficult. But so anyways, decided I was going to start the business, I got the money to get it started, learned how to bake them, and my plan was to bake in a restaurant that was only open at night. I was going to bake there during the day because I had to have an approved kitchen. There wasn't a cottage law like there is now where you can actually bake in your house and legally sell it in stores, so I had to get an approved kitchen. So
by approved, you meant commercial?
Commercial kitchen.
Commercial kitchen that was... has been inspected by the health department, has stamp and everything that you could actually sell product.
So I had already pre-sold. I got the newspaper, the local newspaper, to do an article on me. They had it scheduled for like, I think it was in 2 weeks from that point, 2 weeks out on a Sunday. And so I had these orders, I had an article coming up, I had a place to bake it. I picked the day I was going to bake. I went and I tried to bake, and I baked about 3,000 cookies, but I learned that humidity really affects baking that day. So I ended up having to throw all those cookies away.
Oh my God. 3,000?
By hand, 2 spoons. And I didn't know why they had ruined. I did it exactly like my grandmother said. So anyways, long story short, I jumped around to a couple different places to try different ovens because I thought that's what it was. And ended up finding that restaurant I was mentioning earlier that had was abandoned and wasn't being used. So I used that for about 2 years and grew to about 35 stores around the state of Alabama, mostly boutique kind of stores. And
now, walk us through that, because for many of our guerrillapreneurs in the audience that are just getting off the ground, you just spoke magic. You went from 3 stores to 35, and there are lots of folks who haven't gotten into one yet. How did you manage that? How did you get from 3 to 35?
Well, it's kind of funny. Like, now Google is so much better at search than it was back then. I can see. But what I would do is I would literally Google, like, you know, Montgomery's 45 miles from here. I would say specialty store in Montgomery.
Right.
And whatever popped up on Yelp at the time or whatever, I'd kind of do as much research as I possibly could. I'd literally just write them down on a sheet of paper. I'd make some samples. I'd get in the car get up in my kitchen at, like, I'd be there about 5, and I'd bake, and then leave town about 9, and head over to, you know, Montgomery, drive around Montgomery for a couple hours, and, you know, walk in with some samples and say, you know, it's a pretty easy product to sell.
Right.
It's not complicated. You know.
Right. Cookies, people want cookies, right.
And so I just picked a target in a certain city and would go drop off samples, and most people didn't want to talk to me, but I just said, try them, I'll give you a call. And so I usually try them. I give a couple days and give them a call, and usually they place an order.
How'd you get past the no? You said some people didn't want to try. Was it just try the cookie?
Yeah,
how did you fight past the no?
Well, I would just say, I understand you're busy. Here's some samples. You know, it's my grandmother's recipe. Here's a little information about it. Just whenever you have time, try them, and I'll reach back out to you.
So, out of 10 stores, how many people turned you away?
I would say half of them were not real nice. I mean, because, you know, most of them are just getting bombarded every day with people that are, you know, have something to sell. And so most people weren't very nice on the initial, you know, meeting. And I probably wasn't very good at it. You know, I was probably awkward or whatever. But I knew the cookies and product would speak for itself. And I did have a little experience with cold calling. I worked in Birmingham. I sold a complicated product and, you know, spent my day cold calling, and it was a good get my feet wet kind of thing.
Right.
So cookies was a lot more fun.
Right. And it toughened up the skin with a more complicated product. Probably got a lot of no's.
Absolutely.
Got used to it and figured out how to get a yes.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, so you're 35 stores now. You've gotten a number of yeses, obviously, and starting to get some momentum.
Yeah, started getting momentum. And, you know, when I started, I was making them by hand. I knew I needed to speed up the process, but then, you know, my inexperience in that industry, I didn't know what the next steps were as far as, like, equipment and just what I didn't even know what I needed to make the cookie. And so I got a local engineer to come look at how I was doing the cookies. He was nice enough to kind of donate some of his time. And we ended up creating a stainless steel nozzle, like that fit down in an empty caulk tube. And we took a pneumatic caulking gun, and I put a little, it was like a stainless steel plug on the end. So I'd stuff the tube with dough, put a plug on the end, stick it on my little gun, and I would shoot out the dough like until I rope for them. And we took scissors, and it was kind of tricky because the scissors would get sticky the more you cut, so you have to, like, dip them in water to keep them cutting. And so that actually, like, doubled my production speed.
Wow, okay.
But it still wasn't enough to really
launch a business, but you could at least get enough volume where people could start to say you got a model that could scale.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, I called it the kitchen cookie prison because I was in there for so long. And I didn't really start the business because I loved baking.
Right.
And that's what I was doing most of the time, was baking. And so, you know, you're sitting in that kitchen and you're going, there's got to be a better way to do this, you know.
Right.
And so I kind of burned myself out because my mentality at the time was like, I'm just going to work as hard as I possibly can. And after about 2 years, I was just, you know, I'm sick of this and I got to do something else. So and I'm not making money, you know, I wasn't making a profit. I was hardly able to support myself just because I didn't have the volume. You know, I needed a bunch of stores to get the volume, but I didn't have the production to be able to even talk to those stores. So I was just so new to it and so naive, I didn't really know how to take it to the next level.
So you were stuck in cookie prison, doom loop, chicken and egg, everything, every way you want to describe it. You couldn't get past the point of making a, to make a profit until you got more scale. That's couldn't right. get more scale until you got more profit. It was that dilemma that every entrepreneur faces. Yeah. So you what did you do next?
Well, I decided to put the business on pause. I kind of said, I'm going to pull back and I'm going to maybe do this later down the road, but I'm going to try a few other ideas that I've been sitting in here baking cookies, thinking of all these other business ideas, which I don't know if other entrepreneurs have the same issue, but you're always trying to find an easier way. And you got so many ideas, it's hard to focus, and that was a pretty good learning experience. I had so many ideas built up in me from sitting there baking all the time that I wanted to try them. And I did. So for the next year and a half, I did a number of things. I had a, I won't go into all of them, but the, I had a job posting website for Tuscaloosa, Alabama for students. I had a business that I sold GPS monitors for juvenile offenders. And that actually got off the ground for a little while, but ended up crashing pretty bad. I had people that were had the devices on and we couldn't find them. That's a whole other story. And then
kind of takes the GPS out of GPS, right? When you can't find it.
Around, was it? It's like Lauderdale, not Lauderdale County, Marion County. It's about 3 hours from here, looking for a guy that
had your GPS tag.
GPS tag on it. And then I did sold beef and pork to the military. That wasn't didn't get anywhere. And then I sold I had a T-shirt business online. I printed T-shirts. And had like a brand online, and that actually did pretty well. And the way I was making money, the way I was surviving during this time, is I had taught myself how to build websites, and so I was I had picked up a handful of projects that I was doing. So that was how I was sort of paying my bills, which were very small at the time. So. But so kind of fast forward through that.
Let's unpack that. What did you pull from that time? Because most entrepreneurs do take a break.
Yeah.
Warren Buffett ran his company in the ground, bankrupt, took a break, and said, "What did I learn from that?" Out of that came Berkshire Hathaway, and now he's the third or fourth richest man in the world. That break gave him the opportunity to get context of saying, do I really want to be in this manufacturing business, or is it a better way for me to buy businesses, leverage them, and make billions? And I think that insight, that aha moment, came to him when you got out of manufacturing prison. So what did you take from those three ventures? You know, the GPS, the T-shirt business, what ahas came to you that helped you in the next iteration?
I think the main thing was just focus. I didn't really have, I was trying to do too many things at one time, and just not that I didn't have the ability to, I just didn't realize it was such an important thing to focus on what you got, especially when you're trying to build a business. I mean, it takes everything and then some. And to be spread out, you just end up doing everything you do okay. You don't do anything excellent. And so that was one of the things I learned. But it did also kind of set me up for what we'll talk about in a minute, the second phase, because I was able to try and learn things in those different ventures that I was able to then take into, I was able to learn how to do an e-commerce website and really market that. I kind of improved my sales call ability with the GPS monitoring thing. Was at the job posting website I tried a bunch of different marketing tactics that most didn't work, but I was able to sort of like try some things that I would never had the chance to do. And then there's a bunch of things. I mean, with the job posting website, market's so small. GPS monitoring, I learned that the product was the problem, and I was trying to get by with a product that wasn't ready for the market. And then the T-shirt business, the market wasn't big enough, and I wasn't passionate enough to keep it.
Those are all great learnings. Yeah. A number of the best accelerators in the country look for guys with experience like what you just described. not the rocket to the moon type, you know, ventures, but those guys who have actually failed and learned something from it, because it sets the stage for sustained success. Because like you said, if the product's not right, you know it as the entrepreneur. Yeah. Certainly you know it the next time around.
Yeah.
And the marketing tactics, no matter what's written in a book, until you've gone through it and felt it and understand how it resonates with your target market,
yeah,
it just doesn't. It just won't ever take off. Okay, so those learnings set the stage for phase two.
Yeah.
All right. So tell us about what happened in phase two.
Yeah. So I had an opportunity to work with a guy here in Selma that he came to me about after I'd kind of done all these different business ideas, and I was kind of he knew I was sort of looking for the next chapter. And he said, look, I want you to come up with a business idea that I can sort of get behind, and I will help you live for 6 months. So get me whatever expenses just to barely get by, I will help you do that. And so I started for about 4 months, spending my day brainstorming, coming up with different ideas, having doing research, you know, talking to, you know, if I had an idea, I'd kind of go down a rabbit trail to see if I could, you know, prove any sort of concept. And through that process, I was sitting in the post office, Selma, Alabama. I was sitting there, I'll never forget when it kind of came back to me, but I thought, you know, what I'm trying to do is what I've already done with the cookies.
Mm-hmm.
I proved that these things would sell.
Mm-hmm.
I proved that people, even after I shut the business down, I had phone calls all the time with people saying, you know, we need to get some more cookies for our store or whatever. And so I knew that I'd proven, or I felt like I'd proven that they would sell if I could get the price point right and if I could get over the hurdles that I had, which was, you know, I needed the production capability to be able to even talk. I needed volume. So all the pieces that fit the bake volume possible, the production capacity and the ability to, you know, make those kind of sales. Mm-hmm. Those are the pieces I need to put together. And so at that point, I feel like I'd learned so much I'd grown so much in like business sense. I felt like that I could tackle that. And so I decided that I was going to start it again. And so that's what I did.
Yeah. Okay. So you have a backer. You're confident that phase two is going to take you to another level.
Mm-hmm.
What were your first major investments, and then how did that recast G Mama's Cookies?
Yeah, so he and the backer was mostly just, you know, to help me survive. So it would have been another round of investment in to get it off the ground. But what I did initially was I kind of had to figure out, all right, what are my steps here? What do I do first? Because here are all the things I need, but it's the chicken or the egg kind of thing. But so I need a bakery that can bake them for me because I need the capacity. I can't, you know, the equipment needed to be able to do orders for big retailers would just be too expensive. I don't have a product, you know, and I need access to these buyers. I need to be able to get in these buyers' offices, and I know from my previous experience that it's next to impossible because they're just getting inundated with people every day. I mean, you know, Walmart's buyer, Winn-Dixie, or even smaller store chains. But so I needed those two things, and with my previous experience with my other ventures, I had, you know, branding and all that kind of stuff. I didn't worry too much about that, and I could build websites, so I mean, I could do some things. But so I figured out my first step was to get the salesman. Mm-hmm. To agree. So if I could get them to agree to sell the product, then I'd have a little bit of leverage to go to some of these bakeries, because I learned through some of my conversations through the first go-around when I was trying to get maybe a contract bakery that volume was key. Like they weren't even talk to you unless you had, you know, big volume. And so I ended up finding a group of brokers around the country, brokers or salespeople that would sell the product for me, who already had those established relationships with the buyers that I wanted to get into. I got a verbal commitment from them. So I made samples myself in my home. I sent them out to, I found a local guy who has contacts with brokers all over, and he said, you know, here's the people to call. And so I contacted all these brokers, and they gave me addresses, and I sent samples to probably 30 different people around the country. And most of all of them said, you know, oh, great, great. You know, if this guy can make them, then we'll sell them. And so I had a verbal commitment. So that was like, okay, this is my first step. Now I've got some leverage. And so I started just calling, using Google. One phone call lead to another, trying to find a contract bakery. I drove to Chattanooga, talked to one in Virginia, California, all these different places. And most people wouldn't, you know, want to talk more than 15 seconds to me on the phone, or said they'd call me back, and they never would, and I could never get back up with them. Because, you know, the first question is, great, you sound, you know, I sound like a young guy on the phone. And they're like, so, hey, cool, you're the 100th person that's called today that said they've got a grandmother's cookie recipe that we want us to bake. So how much volume are you doing a month? And I'd say, well, nothing. And so then I was able to say, I've got a group of brokers that are spread out across the country that are chomping at the bit to sell this. Because I can do my sales job, you know, a little bit with the bakery. And I just need somebody to bake it. And so anyways, long story short, through a call in for months, really, probably about 6 weeks, I finally got a lead on one in Pennsylvania. And it was a bakery that was a facility that was older, but it was just had come under new ownership. They were only about 50% capacity. They needed the business. I needed a bakery, so it ended up being a good fit. I called them, and we started the process of, you know, kind of the initial steps and all that.
Let's unpack this for the audience. Now, for you guys out there that are listening, I hope you caught what Robert just laid out there. He had a chicken and egg problem, as many of you do who are running your business, as I've had, as every entrepreneur has gone through this problem. People aren't going to get excited until they know that there's some demand, some volume out there. And until you get that commitment or find a way to break that egg and make an omelet, you're never going to get past first step. And so by getting the sellers out there willing to sell to generate volume, you were able to leverage that to get a bakery. Fortunate enough to find one that was hungry, that wanted the business and would take a risk on this product. But that's what most of you struggle with. And that's why you hear me from time to time talk about executive capacity, right? Certain things you gotta outsource early on to help you crack that egg and make that omelet, because you can't do everything.
Yeah.
Turning it over to an expert seller gave you that opportunity to crack that egg.
Yeah.
And so when that relationship was established, what happened next?
Well, it's such a, especially getting into a market that you don't really know much about. I mean, I knew a little bit about the boutique, you know, real specialty type market, but I was getting into more of the grocery, specialty food, like, you know, Whole Foods, Fresh Market, those kind of stores. And so when you get into that realm, it's a whole nother ballgame. And so being able to have sort of these brokers, one, and then the bakery to sort of lean on for not necessarily advice, but expertise. I mean, even just down to like a price sheet and what are the margins from me to the retailer, and how much markup is this store looking for? And being able to ask those questions with a broker was invaluable, because that way you're able to, you know, set your pricing and know your cost and your margins and all that. And coming into it blind, you don't really
know what you don't know.
You don't know what you don't know until you don't know it.
Right.
You know.
And that's when it could be in the ditch at that point, exactly. Right?
And so having those was not only help getting into some of the buyer's offices, but it was also great because, you know, when I had to do my pricing sheet, you know, I said, all right, well, here's the price I'm thinking. Where is this going to be if I sell it to this retailer? What is that going to be on the shelf? What's the retail price on the shelf? So then I could go into that retailer. Just take, for instance, like, you know, Fresh Market. If I sell it to them at X and they put 40% on it, what is that going to be on the shelf? Mm-hmm. And am I going to be competitive with what's out there? So that expertise was invaluable. And then, so that's from a sales standpoint and a marketing standpoint, from an operational standpoint, and a recipe and those kind of things. The bakery, having a partner like that is invaluable too, because they're going to be able to bring nutritional facts. They're going to be able to bring expertise as far as like shelf life goes and all the things you don't think about with a product that you have to have. And they're going to help. They don't say, it's not like it's that's what they offer. It just ends up, that's having a partner. That's just kind of what happens in a partnership.
So yeah, they bring in production level capabilities, some of it regulated requirements, and they're bringing that to that expertise to you so that you don't have to learn it.
Absolutely.
And certainly in this business, we have perishables, and until you figure out kind of the rate of your turns on those shelves, you want to have a product that's stable, that's going to taste good from first day to 12th day that it's been on the shelf. And those guys helped you do that.
Absolutely.
So it sounds like you cracked that egg and things were getting ready to really take off.
Oh, I was excited. I mean, I was, you know, I felt like I, you know, this was it. My grandmother was still alive at this point. She even said, I met with her once I kind of got the design of the bag. I used a designer that worked with on my t-shirts that really had a style that I thought was, that would fit the kind of brand that I was looking for. And I kind of tweaked the branding a little bit, made it easier for not just Southerners, but the national, demographics to sort of be able to read. When I first started, I called it Gami Mama, and people said Gami Mama. And so I just made it G Mamas for short. And I got him to do the design, and I was able to show her before she passed, you know, the what the bag was going to look like with her face on it. And she even said, she was like, you're going to make it this time. So it was pretty cool. But I got the bags designed, and we started working on the recipe, which, you know, I'd been baking the product with cups and teaspoons. And so going from that to an industrial recipe is a lot different. And, you know, the only way I knew to do it was to say, Google, you know, what does a cup of flour weigh? You know, use that to
scale up the up. Recipe.
We did that in the first couple samples we did. I mean, the cookies were like pancakes. And I didn't know why. I was like, what, you know. So that took a while. I realized, you know, through that process that, you know, it was very, very scientific, and we had to nail down the amount of ingredients and then the process of mixing it. You know, sometimes if you mix the eggs too much, or you don't, the dough sits too long, or there's too much sugar, it spreads too much, or is that the butter, or is, you know, moisture content, how much humidity is in the, and all those things I was able to learn over time, but initially I didn't know anything about it.
It's a precise science to getting it exactly the same every time, and the operations associated with that, certainly as your scale becomes paramount, that you have it completely nailed down. You could have never done that out of your kitchen to the volume that you wanted to do, but the kitchen served as a great model, and then you figured out a way to bridge that when you went to the outsourced baker.
Yeah.
So what success did you see from that arrangement?
Yeah, I mean, initially I got into, so once we had gotten the recipe down, I had samples, I came back and started selling, and had sent, we did a sample run. I sent samples to all the brokers, like selling samples that they could take to their buyers. I took some samples. There was a distributor in Birmingham that I had a relationship with from the previous go-around, first go-around with the cookies, but just wasn't big enough to work with them then. Contacted them, met with them. They were a food service distributor that did some distributing to specialty food. And so this is how I initially got my first order with the bakery, is I went to this distributor and said, I'd like for y'all to distribute my product in Alabama and the Southeast. And they said, well, we'd love to distribute it, but we're not going to go out and sell it for you. If you've got the customers to bring to us, we'll distribute it to them. They gave me a list of about 40 stores throughout Alabama and the Panhandle. And then for about 2 weeks, I just drove around the state of Alabama, hitting all those stores and doing similar to what I did before, hand samples. And I was able to tell them this time, I know you order from, it was Wood Frutiger, it's in Birmingham. I said, I know you order product from Wood Frutiger already. These are going in to Wood Frutiger, so it won't be any change in your system. Just here's the item code numbers. If you like them, order them, and I'll follow up with you in a week. So we ended up getting into about 25 stores just right off the bat from them. And at the same time, just right down the road, there was a distributor for independent drugstores. They had about 150 independent drugstores. And I got an appointment with them all within the same about 2 weeks and got them to order. So that was about 150 stores. In total, about 200 stores just right off the bat. So that was enough stores for me to place my first order with the bakery, enough volume for them to turn their ovens on.
Turn it on, right.
And so I got enough for them and then a little bit of back inventory. And so I was, or at least that was my plan. So send in the PO to the bakery. I get an article on AL.com to do a kind of a, you know,
kind of media.
They were back in business and here's the story and that kind of thing. And so the day comes for them to bake. And again, this, you know, a couple of months earlier, we had baked the product that I liked. We finally got it right. And I was happy with it and everything. And I was there when they did it. So I get the article, I get the orders, they take the order and they bake it, and I'm in Selma, they're in Pennsylvania, and they put them in bags up there, and I get them shipped from Pennsylvania to the distributor in Birmingham, and article runs, and the cookies get all the way to Selma now and through the distributor, and I'm like, oh cool, I'm gonna go buy some of my own cookies, you know, so I'm excited, so I go to the store and buy them and open the bag, and they're not my cookies.
Oh, no.
They don't taste like my cookies. They're like pancakes again.
Oh, no.
And it wasn't that, it wasn't just that it didn't taste right. They had too much moisture, so the shelf life wasn't going to.
Oh, dude, it wasn't going to stay on the shelf either. Wow. And so wow.
I had a semi-nervous breakdown.
Yeah, I would imagine. Yeah. Right?
It's about $25,000 worth of cookies.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
With your grandmother's face on it.
Yeah.
Everywhere across the Southeast.
Yeah, and they didn't taste bad, and I knew they weren't going to taste bad for about maybe a month. So I had a month. So whatever was in the stores, what I ended up deciding when I kind of calmed down from all of it, and I had a guy here that helped me with the brokers, he kind of helped talk me through some of this. He's an entrepreneur too, so he kind of helped me. But what I decided to do was to just replace the cookies that were in the distributor. So whatever back stock they had, I would replace. Mm. And the way I would handle it, I was just gonna tell them that I wasn't satisfied with the quality. Whatever's in the store is just gonna stay in the store, because I can't drive around to 200 stores and pick them all up. And we'll just replace you with what. So I flew to Pennsylvania, we baked again, and I replaced everything, hooked a trailer to my truck, drove to Birmingham, hit both distributors, we put the pallets on the back of my truck and the back of the trailer, and I drove all those cookies to the food bank. And that happened twice in the first year.
$50,000 worth of cookies.
Yeah.
Robert, how many miles do you have on your truck?
I got 245,000.
How old is this truck?
It's a 2007.
So I have a 2007. I have 280,000. You and I both, same kind of stories. All right, when it goes bad, you got to get in your truck and go make it right. Okay. And, you know, we've talked about that number of times on this podcast, and I think the people who have been through it understand that an entrepreneur's life is stressful.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And you have those instances, even when things look like they're going well, where you literally could drive yourself insane. Like you said, the product on the shelf, that should be celebration time.
Oh, yeah.
You taste the product and realize it's not the product.
Yeah.
And now what do? You don't panic. You figure out a plan.
Yeah.
And so having that mentor there who has the experience that could coach you through it, give you options, really kept you in the business.
Oh, yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about that mentor and what that relationship meant to you.
Yeah, it was huge for us. I mean, or huge for me. You know, at that point, I was still very new to entrepreneurship. I mean, I'd done all these smaller businesses and that kind of thing with a lot less money at stake, you know. But this was my personal debt. I didn't really say that part. But when I relaunched the business, I got a personal line of credit to launch the business. And so this wasn't, you know, somebody else's money. This was the bank's money, and my name was on it. And so, you know, when those cookies went bad and I had to throw them to the food bank, you know, that was me personally taking that hit. And, you know, I don't have anything. You know, I got an old truck, and that's it. And it wasn't even paid off at the time. So yeah, that was pretty difficult. But what it made me hold on to, really, was that I knew the product was good, and I knew, and I had some other interests from other retailers. But that mentor really helped me kind of calm down. No, he's kind of talked me down, like, it's going to be okay. If this thing falls apart, you're going to be fine.
You're going to be fine.
You're going to be fine.
You're going to live. You're going to survive.
And so I just had to get there in my mind, you know.
Right.
It's all going to be okay. And, it was a really good learning experience to get, you know, that much stress, that frustrated, and to be able, and to try to have to deal with it was a very, it's hard, really hard at the time. It happened multiple times throughout this journey, but, you know, my capacity to handle those things has grown just from those
experiences. So you grew from that and then expanded into many more stores.
Yeah. Yeah. So next step, I mean, once I went up there and kind of we did the bake again to replace the cookies. I felt like we had it solid then, which I learned over time. Just a little quick side note is that we had a couple of other mess up bakes throughout this process. A bunch of them, and I couldn't figure out why, but we ended up figuring out how to put some parameters in place to try to keep it, and we tweaked the recipe to try to keep it more stable and everything. But back up to the next customer that I got was World Market. So the way I got that customer was, I mean, pure luck. I got on LinkedIn, found the buyer on LinkedIn, just Googled, you know, cookie buyer, World Market, and sent her a LinkedIn message. And literally, like, the same day, she said, yeah, we'd love to get some samples. So I sent samples. 2 weeks later, she said she was going to put them in all the stores. And next thing you know, I had a $35,000 order from World Market. Yeah. And so at that point, I was like, you know, I made it. This is it. I made it, you know. But I ended up, this is a long, drawn-out story, but I ended up getting in there selling decent for a little while, but ended up getting kicked out of there.
Wow.
And so that was a costly. What I learned is that, you know, I wasn't able to support the sales. I was in a terrible spot on the shelf. You know, it was one of those experiences that you learn that getting the PO is not always you got to be careful when you get the PO. The terms, the conditions, and how it's going to play out once they get the product, you know. So that did get me going. It helped me pay down a line of credit some. And next thing you know, I was getting into Cracker Barrel. Got in Cracker Barrel, 700 stores. I got into, I was selling to, you know, Piggly Wiggly throughout the Southeast. Home Goods, I was in TJ Maxx. I was in a couple small distributors spread out, like one in San Francisco, one in Missouri. I was selling through Groupon at some point. Like, I was selling some of the old inventory through Groupon. That was some of the missed bakes. I got in Walmart. That came about from being in Cracker Barrel. When I got into Cracker Barrel, my broker that got helped me get in there told me, he said, this is going to pave the way for the business. And it really did. It paved them. It made my product appear, and it just elevated our brand, just being in that store. The buyer from Walmart, her boyfriend, went and bought a bag at the local Cracker Barrel in Bentonville, brought them home, and loved them. Told his girlfriend, these are awesome. She reaches out to me. 2 weeks later, we got an appointment. She said she's going to put me in 400 stores.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Makes up for those missed bakes, right? Oh, yeah. You get calls like that.
Oh, yeah. That's what keeps you going.
That's right.
You
know? That roller coaster ride, those are the days that keep you fighting and getting up, right?
Yeah.
Keep you being a gorillapreneur. So at the peak, you're in Walmart, you're in Cracker Barrel, you've been in World Market, you, what, 1,000, 2,000?
2,000 stores.
Different stores, and now you're ready for phase three, expansion, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's going to conclude part one of the interview with Robert Armstrong, the founder of the Selma Good Company and the producers of G Mama's Cookies. You could see he was well on his way to building a cookie empire. In part two of this interview, we're going to discuss the reasons why the cookie crumbled. If you're an entrepreneur or a small business owner, you don't want to miss part two. It's an emotional podcast episode. Robert takes you through all the things that unwound his business, the stress that it put him under, and how he would not have made it through had it not been for the things that we discuss in that podcast episode. Make sure you subscribe and don't miss great interviews like these that teach you how to fight against the Goliaths of the world. I want to give special thanks to Becky Nichols and the staff at the Selma Dallas County Public Library. They allowed us to use their conference room for this interview, and they were very gracious hosts. We appreciate that, and we appreciate everyone in Selma, Alabama, the home of G Mama's Cookies. If you like this podcast, you may like a couple of my other podcasts, Career Coaching X's and O's. If you're an executive and not ready to be an entrepreneur yet, and you want to make a push for the corner office, Career Coaching X's and O's might be the podcast for you. Interested in the gig and sharing economy? Check out my podcast, Gigging, Everything in the Sharing Economy, where you get news, views, and opinions about what's going to happen in the sharing economy that's expected to reach $335 billion by 2025. And before I let you out of this podcast, I want to remind you that I am teaming up with Airbnb Open Homes, a program that enables community members to offer free temporary housing to people displaced by disasters. I don't have to tell you about all the disasters that we've seen in 2019 and now starting 2020. If you are able to offer free temporary housing for neighbors impacted by a disaster, sign up to be an Open Homes host by going to airbnb.com/M Peterson. That's airbnb.com/M as in Mary, P-E-T-E-R-S-O-N. You will only be contacted when there is a need. This will add a great tool to our community's disaster response toolbox. Guerrillapreneurs, Scott Sullivan said it best in episode 7. Be a mace, sharpen those spikes, and remember, if you're not breaking something, your company might be the next thing that gets broke.
Thank you for listening to the Guerrillapreneur, the Art of Waging Small Business Warfare podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, you may also enjoy the book Guerrillapreneur, Small Business Strategy for Davids Wanting to Defeat Goliaths, available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and iTunes. Follow Mark Peterson on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Guerrillapreneur. Now I want to close with a quote from the great Chinese military strategist Sun Tzu. Victorious warriors win first and then go to war, while defeated warriors go to war first, then seek to win. Keep fighting, Guerrillapreneurs!